KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I'm from Milpitas,
Union City.
Mission Bay.
I do not know where I'm from.
Bernal Heights.
And I'm from the Sunset.
Coming up, we're headed behind the scenes inside Bay Area prisons. We'll hear from KALW editors working with men on the inside, and we'll check in with one of the reporters who was recently paroled.
I don't know any other adult life than than when I was inside.
Plus, we'll hear an in-depth conversation with an accomplished artist living on death row.
I want my paintings to be felt. If they are aesthetically pleasing to the eye, then so be it. But if they're ugly, then that is okay too. As long as you can feel it, then I've accomplished my goal.
Stories you won't hear anywhere else today on a special hour-long edition of Cross Currents. Today, we're taking you inside San Quentin State Prison and Solano State Prison, where our editorial team teaches inmates to tell their stories. We'll start today with a piece from San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden, you heard this.
Imagine if you forgot how to speak the language you learned as a child, a language that gave you an identity, a language that says, hey, you belong here. You're one of us. How will your sense of self be impacted? San Quentin Radio's Anutin Pantong sits down with an incarcerated man as he shares his story.
Tên của tôi là David Bơm Lê. Năm nay tôi 33 tuổi. Tôi ở trong tù cũng hơn 10 năm rồi. My name is David Lê. I'm 33 years old and I've been incarcerated for about over 10 years. My ethnic background is Vietnamese American. Vietnamese as a language is part of who I am, and I can't take away or do without it, because I'll be losing a piece of myself. My language ties into my culture and my identity in a way where, if you look at me, right, if I'm telling you that I'm American, clearly there's something wrong because I do not look American. I look Asian, Vietnamese. I don't remember speaking Vietnamese as well was when I think I was in middle school, starting middle school. At that time, I met some of my Vietnamese peers, and to me, they speak Vietnamese very fluently, and I try to converse with them in Vietnamese, but I find it very difficult. I can't find the word to express myself, but I can do it in English, and so I've kind of question myself, why is it so difficult for me to speak in Vietnamese when I speak it at home? Being incarcerated with the progression of losing my Vietnamese language is there's not a lot of, compared to other races in prison, there's not a lot of Vietnamese. It's less than 1% compared to the whole general population. And so it's everywhere you go, there's some other ethnicity or some other race that's not Vietnamese. So it's kind of hard to find my peers, my Vietnamese peers, just to actually just try to communicate and just talk about things in Vietnamese. So it's very difficult. And if I don't find anybody to talk to, I'll slowly lose it. I like to say programs that allow us to learn about our culture, and not just the Vietnamese culture, but all culture. Those programs are rich for our own personal development. And without those programs, I think we're losing a part of ourselves. In a sense, we're losing history.
That story was produced by Anutin Pantong. San Quentin officials listened to and approved the script and audio for this story prior to broadcast. Anutin goes by the name Choi. Choi worked with San Quentin Radio for a couple of years. He's been in prison since he was 15. Then, last month, after serving 22 years behind bars, he was released on parole. We wanted to hear how the transition back into everyday life has been going. So our lead editor for San Quentin Radio, Marissa Ortega Welch, sat down with him at the office of his new job in downtown San Francisco to catch up.
Talk us through
the day of your release?
I didn't even sleep at all. So I think I was just so antsy and anxious and, you know, just looking forward to my release. I couldn't sleep even if I wanted to. I got to the van. The van crossed the gate, passed the gate, and I walked out of the van, and my family was there. My niece, my nephews ran over and gave me a hug, and my mom was right there, and you know, breaking down, and here I am trying to hold it together, and I couldn't hold it together. I broke down. Yeah, it was really an amazing feeling that morning. And afterwards, we went back to the hotel. My family had spent the night at the hotel.
Because they came in from out of town.
Yeah, and my brothers asked me, hey, what do you want to eat? I was like, oh, I really love mom's cooking. I miss it so much. Mom, can I want to eat some bamboo soup. Just this dish in Laos is called lap, which is like minced meat, right? Meat of your choice. Duck, pork, chicken. I chose the chicken, and she went all out. Had the bamboo soup, had the papaya salad, had the lap, some, of course, sticky rice. We had a feast in the hotel lobby.
Then what did you do?
We actually went to the city, and one of the first places I went to the city was the beach, Baker's Beach. Took my shoes off, my socks off, put my toes in the water, and it felt really, really great. It was lovely.
What was it like to cross the Golden Gate Bridge?
Oh, in San Quentin. Every night, on the fifth tier, in West Block, you can see the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, laying on my bunk, looking out the window and seeing this bridge, you know, it was like, for me at that moment, it was like a beacon of hope. So here I am crossing the bridge in the car. All I did was just film it, the whole stretch. It was beautiful.
So then what'd you do after the beach?
Then reality hit. I had to report to my parole officer, and I still haven't slept. Now it's been more than 24 hours. I was going off of adrenaline. And going to my parole officer's office gave me the do's and don'ts and, you know, when to report and what to look forward to with him. It was like an awakening, like, yes, I'm free, but at the same time, not free. So on Mother's Day, I couldn't even go visit my mother because of the 50-mile radius restriction that I have because of parole.
What surprised you about being out?
One of the biggest surprises since I've been out is how accepting people are. That was one of my biggest concerns, you know, on the inside, is like, how will people perceive me? Are there going to be any judgment? But no, it is like totally opposite. I'm working in an office building where people know my past. And people are very accepting of it and forgiving as well. I'm really, really blessed in that way that people see me as what I can do and what I can offer, you know, not what I've done in my past.
What's been hard for you?
I left some really great people back in prison. And the connection that I've built with some of the folks on the inside is really strong. And, you know, I'm out here able to live life and enjoy it. And, you know, it's a great feeling to have that freedom of choice. But also at the same time, it kind of like saddens me because my friends on the inside are still struggling. Some of them don't know if they're ever getting out. One thing that I did notice, the difference between folks that's on the inside and the folks on the outside, is out here, people don't take the time to really like make eye contact. And if anything, I do miss that, right? Because I'm walking on the sidewalk and passing people up. People are looking at their phone or, you know, just giving that look that, hey, don't look at me, don't talk to me, don't want to be bothered. I just want to go from A to B, right? On the inside, it's totally opposite. We look people in the eye. You know, this signifies that, hey, you know, I'm about to cross your space right now, or even for like survival, or, you know, if I know you, it's an acknowledgement that you exist, right? I don't get that out here. Sometimes I catch myself chasing eyeballs, and which is crazy because here I'm looking all like a creep, right? I'm looking like a creep, like I'm trying to just try to make eye contact. The people don't do that.
Well, I wanted to ask more about those programs. You did a lot of programs in your time in San Quentin. You were part of programs that help youth offenders. You were in restorative justice programs, arts programs like Shakespeare and drama, also San Quentin Radio. We just heard a story that you produced for San Quentin Radio. What did those programs mean to you then when you were on the inside, and how are you drawing on them now?
I got into a lot of trouble in Solano. I actually got transferred out of Solano. That wasn't a great feeling to be already in prison and then to be kicked out of a prison. That's crazy, right? Like, who gets kicked out of a prison? That was me. But, and you know, when I was in San Quentin, I had the opportunity to really work on myself, you know, and I really give thanks, you know, and appreciate the folks who run these programs, right, and giving me access. And I think that was what was missing, is access. With access, we know comes a lot of things: empowerment, knowledge, you know, confidence. Looking back at the access that I was afforded, I feel really grateful for that.
What are your goals, hopes, and dreams, and what's next for you?
I want to be accountable to myself. Being incarcerated since I was 15, I grew up in the prison system, and I don't know any other adult life than, you know, than when I was inside. Here I am, 22 years later, and it's like I'm thrown into the deep end right now, and I'm adjusting really well. But also at the same time, there's like a ton of people who support me, which makes this adjustment for me very easy. You know, I understand that a lot of other folks who are being released don't have the type of support that I have. And so here I am today in San Francisco in an office, you know, looking back at the access that I was afforded, and I'm, you know, I feel really grateful for that. You know, and I want to continue to be involved in, you know, advocating for folks who can't really advocate for themselves.
That was Anuten Pantong, or Choi, speaking with KLW's Marissa Ortega Welch. Choi was part of San Quentin Radio until he was paroled last month. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're going to delve deeper into KLW's journalism training programs inside prisons. We're joined now by the project lead for San Quentin Radio, Marissa Ortega Welch.
Hi.
Hi.
And also with us is Eli Wertschafter. He is heading up a brand new KLW project at Solano State Prison. Hey, Eli.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi. So, Marissa, let's start with you. Let's talk about the San Quentin program. Why don't you start by telling us about the San Quentin program? When did it start? What was the initial idea?
So KLW has been going into San Quentin since 2013. It was started by our former news director, Holly Kernan, and a handful of volunteers on the outside, and also people on the inside incarcerated in San Quentin who wanted to be telling their stories and learning how to make all kinds of media stories, not just radio, but video as well. When we started going in, there weren't a lot of media programs, and our program has grown a lot in the last couple of years, and other media programs have grown as well. There's a whole media lab in San Quentin, people inside producing not just radio stories, but video, documentaries. There's San Quentin News, a newspaper that's distributed in prisons across the country. So there's a lot of media coming out of San Quentin, and we're really happy to be a part of it and get to air some of the radio stories on our station.
What are the trainings like? What do you go in and actually do?
So we train people inside San Quentin really similar to how we train interns at our KLW Audio Academy here at the station. The only difference is we have to go to them, and there's no internet. That's pretty much the only difference. So we do a lot more printing out of paper, but we teach them everything from how to think of a good idea for a radio story all the way to doing interviews, cutting tape, editing, writing a script, recording it, and then it does go through a communications officer to get approved, and then we play it on our station.
How was the response to this? Was it immediately, you know, enthusiastic? Did people want to be a part of this immediately? Were people iffy?
on the inside, people, I think, have always been pretty enthusiastic. I mean, I think there's a couple things going on. I think people inside are really hungry for just things to do, but especially things that are meaningful that they can learn from, that they can potentially even leave prison someday and have, you know, a job skill set, something to put on their resume, and different skills that they can carry into any line of work. They're also really hungry to have their voices and stories heard, right? They feel like they're locked away and that people forget about them. And so they want to make sure that they're heard and give a perspective about prison that maybe challenges some of the stereotypes that we might see or hear in mainstream media.
So it's about feeling heard.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're starting a new project.
That's right.
A different prison.
Yeah,
Eli.
So this one's at Solano State Prison in Vacaville. So that's about halfway to Sacramento. And the kind of stories we're producing there are a little bit different. Those are, it's more in the style of StoryCorps. Mm. So there's like a conversation between two people who know each other that's edited down into a 2 to 5 minute audio gem.
That sounds more involved. Is it?
It's a little simpler on the editing side because compared to these features that are coming out of San Quentin where there's a lot of different voices and maybe some other sound happening, this is more simple. This is just two people with two microphones. It's actually still very complicated as a producer to edit that stuff down, but we hope it'll be a little simpler starting off than what we're doing already at San Quentin.
How's it been so far?
It's been awesome. We just started a few weeks ago. We have 7 prisoners who are in the program, and they are, like, one of them's a poet, there's a musician, a banjo player, a couple Shakespearean actors, people who work on the newspaper inside Solano Prison, a computer programmer. So people with all these different skills, different ages, different interests, and who are just very excited to be doing this work.
Marissa, what is it like to visit these prisons, you know, kind of to walk into this different world? And you mentioned the teaching process is similar, but again, for example, there's no internet or these other really, really big changes that you have to work with. What's it like walking in?
Yeah, so there's also no cell phones allowed, right? So I have to leave my phone in the car, which is an interesting experience since I usually have it on me all day and I'm kind of checking it obsessively, sadly. So I leave my phone in the car. I walk into the prison. It does sort of feel like what you'd stereotypically think about a prison to feel like as you go through all these different security gates. There are these giant heavy metal doors that feel like you're going through a fortress. But actually, when you make it past the last security checkpoint and you're officially sort of in the San Quentin prison where people who are incarcerated are walking around, I often feel like, this is going to sound very weird, I feel like Dorothy when she arrives into the land of color, in the land of Oz, because the gardens of San Quentin, who are maintained by people who are incarcerated, are beautiful. And so you get through all these, you know, gray and really ugly security checkpoints, and then you're in this very beautiful, colorful place, which is not what I expected going in. And then I walk through the prison yard, which does feel like kind of the prison yard that you maybe see in a movie. There's guys playing basketball, guys, you know, lifting weights. And I get to the media lab, which is in the back of the yard. And there, another thing a lot of people ask me is, you know, are there correctional officers in the room with us? And there actually aren't. We're allowed to be in the room with the people that we work with. We have our own classroom, just kind of like we'd have here at KALW. And I have to say, another thing that might surprise people is that the day that I go in there is often the day of the week, of my week, where I smile the most, I laugh the most, and I have a really incredible time. I mean, I think these people inside, I don't mean to romanticize it, I think given their conditions and given what they're living with, they maintain an extremely positive attitude. And I think they use laughter to get through their day. And so I definitely benefit from that. I feel really happy when I'm there and really present.
Eli, you've been at San Quentin and Solano. What are some of the differences you've noticed?
Yeah, they're similar security levels, but actually the prisons are very different. Solano really does not have the same number of volunteer programs as San Quentin does. Mm. And from what I hear, Solano is becoming more like what San Quentin is.
Because of this program.
Because of this program and because of other rehabilitative programs that are coming to Solano now. So Our program, both of our programs are funded by the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation as part of a general push to decrease the size of the prison population and provide more rehabilitative opportunities. And so now some of those are coming to Solano as well. Mm-hmm. And so they're seeing a culture shift.
All right, guys. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Ana.
Thanks.
That's Marissa Ortega-Welch, project lead for San Quentin Radio, and Eli Wirtschafter, who heads the Solano Prison Storytelling Project. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. About 750 incarcerated people have been sentenced to death in California. One of them is William Noguera. He's a Colombian-American who grew up in a suburb of L.A., and he spent nearly 30 years on San Quentin's death row for murdering his girlfriend's mother when he was a teenager. Noguera grew up in prison. That's where he discovered his passion for art. And over the last three decades, he's become an accomplished painter and shown his work in galleries around the world. This year, Seven Stories Press published his memoir, Escape Artist, Memoir of a Visionary Artist on Death Row. KALW's Ben Trefney reached William Noguera by phone on death row to talk about his life, his crimes, and his art.
So can you describe for me where exactly you are right now?
Yes, I'm in at San Quentin Prison on the fourth tier of the East Block Bayside, which is the main housing unit for all death row prisoners in the state of California.
What are you looking at right now?
A wall. My cell is only 4.5 feet by 9 feet deep, and I'm actually sitting with my back against the east wall, and my feet are planted against the west wall because it's that small. You can actually stand the center of my cell, stick out one arm, and I can't fully extend the other arm. And it's the same for the roof. If I reach up, I can actually touch the top of the concrete box that I live in.
And what's your day been like up to this point?
I woke up early this morning at 4:30 as I normally do. I wrote for maybe 2.5 hours on my latest literary project. I painted for about 3.5-4 hours, and then I started preparing for this interview.
And aside from the interview that we're conducting right now, is that pretty typical for your day, and how does the rest of your day play out on a general basis?
Well, normally, it really depends on what my plans are. If I decide to go outside, which I decide by 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30, they start running yard. They pass out cuffs. And if I do go outside, I go to one of the seven different yards that are on death row. I'm on yard 6. And I spend the portion of that day working out. I basically stay to myself, and I come back in around 1 o'clock. And then I return to just what I normally do, which is writing and painting the entire night till about 12 o'clock midnight. And the day starts again at 4:30 the next morning. It's a repetitive process that I've been doing now for 30.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And of course, they let you know if they're listening in and recording everything that we're saying.
Yeah, and you were saying that you've been doing that same routine for over 30 years?
I have been, yes.
How do you cope with that?
It's really a matter of perspective. There are people in this world that have different prisons, physical prisons, emotional prisons, prisons of concrete, even social prisons. I've chosen to look at it in that perspective, that I'm healthy, I have a very strong mind, and I have goals to accomplish. You know, the first goal was to find myself, to understand who I was as a man, who I was as a person, and evaluate that honestly. Because the most important part is to be honest with yourself. I always have a goal I always have a set of standards I have to meet, and that's how I cope with this situation. It's not easy. I don't think it's for everybody, and God knows I don't wish it upon my worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a situation I'm in, and I will deal with it in a positive manner.
You were 18 when you committed the crime that led you to prison, and I'm wondering if you could talk about what your childhood was like.
Well, there were very good moments. Before the age of 7, I was very happy. I had two parents who adored each other. They adored us. And I spent the first 7 years of my life in a state of happiness. I had a father who completely loved me, taught me everything I knew, from hunting and fishing to working with my hands, because both of my parents are artists. Unfortunately for them, they could not really become artists. They had to be parents and raise a family. So a very, very good childhood at the age of 7. Then came this trip that we took to South America, Colombia, to my family. And my father basically found out that he was being betrayed. And when we came back, my entire childhood just turned upside down, and it turned into a living hell full of brutality, abuse. I experienced alcoholism from my father, emotional neglect from my mother. It turned, you know, a child with a lot of optimism, a child with a lot of, you know, goodness inside of him, to a very sullen, angry child that basically didn't know his own way around his own family. And of course, there was the worst part, which was to actually deal with the racism that I went through as a child. I lived in a predominantly black and Mexican neighborhood, and since I'm not either one, I was bullied and victimized, and it was very horrible. I experienced probably the worst thing a child could go through, which was complete isolation.
So you detail in the book a very violent life. I'm wondering, how many fights have you been in?
That's a really difficult, because when I was a child, it was an everyday situation. I want you to visualize this. I would leave my house as a 7-year-old little boy, going to school in the second grade, or maybe in the third grade. And when I got to the end of my street, I had to make a choice. If I went left, the Crips would jump me and beat me up. If I went to the right, the Mexican Cholos would jump me. So every day I would walk down the street knowing that before I got to school, or as I arrived at school, I would get into a fight. Every day. My mother once, because I got beat up so badly when I was, I think, 8 years old, I had two black eyes, a broken nose, that she said, look, from now on, I'm going to give you 15 cents for your lunch and 10 cents for an ice cream. And I'm going to give you another 25 cents you put in your pocket. The first one you put in your shoe. So when those kids come to take your money, you give them the money in your pocket and they're going to leave you alone. Of course, that's the easy way out of this. And that's what every little boy should have done. But in my mind, I thought, wow, 25 cents, that's $1.25 a week. And when the first little boy came up to me, well, he wasn't that little, it was about 4 of them, and told me, give me your money, I told him, absolutely not. And I fought. And every single day that I can remember, from the first grade to the sixth grade, I fought every single day.
Mm. Were there adults who could help out with that? Like, did you find any at schools, or was there anybody who you felt you could really turn to for help?
Absolutely not. If I went to my father with an emotional situation, his response was immediate. It was either a backhand or, do you want to put on a dress? There was nothing back then. Outside sources couldn't help me. I couldn't go to friends. And the truth of the matter is, I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't know how to go to somebody else. And, you know, I look back at that kid that I was, and, you know, it's very sad. And I can see how I turned to different things.
Yeah, tell me about that. What turned you to, you know, start criminal behavior?
Well, that came a little bit later on. But, you know, it was always the same thing. Bullied, not accepted. And I began to look for ways around things. I mean, I wanted to score a point for the home team. I was tired of being bullied. I couldn't fight back physically. I wasn't big enough. I was also the runt. I mean, before I turned the age of 13, I was 5'1", 104 pounds. I was the littlest guy in the class.
I can relate to that.
Right? So there was a part of me, I do have a mind that grasps a lot of situations very quickly. And I learned that I had a photographic memory when it came to numbers. So I began to using ways of how to get around that or use it to my advantage. I would learn the, as I mentioned in the book, a person's locker number. I'd open the locker. I'd take his lunch. I'd throw it away. I would take people's homework just to watch them go through some of the struggles that I went through. And that's how I really started. I began to like it. I began to like the power that I felt that I had by stealing something that wasn't mine. It's basically an ethical erosion. I drew lines, and I kept crossing those lines. As I did so, the bigger things that I did didn't seem so big anymore. I began at the age of 15 to steal cars. But I didn't just want to steal cars. I wanted to be the best car thief in the world. So I practiced. It's one of the things I do. I can't be second best, and that's probably something my father instilled in me. And that's how my criminal behavior started. It was first as a mechanism to deal with all the things I was feeling. But then I began to like it.
That's William Noguera speaking from San Quentin's death row with KLW's Ben Trefney.
California voters in the last election, they faced an opportunity to end the death penalty in California or to try to speed it up, and the majority voted to speed it up. Right now, there's several court cases that are pending to stop the block on executions from happening, even though there hasn't been an execution in the state for over a decade. That could change soon. Do you think you'll be executed someday?
Yeah, there's always that fear in the back of my mind. Of course, I would be a fool not to think that way. The court system could rule against me, but I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that everything I'm doing, that the butterfly effect is going to happen, that maybe somebody's going to notice, and I will be given an opportunity to at least state my case in front of a parole board, that I have been rehabilitated, that I'm no longer that, you know, young boy who made the grave mistakes that I've made. So I'm optimistic, but also afraid.
Yeah, I mean, there has not been an execution in the state, you know, as I said, for over a decade, but you've been incarcerated for so long. You have been on death row when there have been executions. And you said that they really jarred you.
They did. You know, it's like being right next to a slaughterhouse, and you're one of the cows in line. So of course, it jarred me. It completely shattered my state of mind. I recognized my own mortality more than I had before. And it actually changed a lot of things inside of me. That jarring, that moment of realization really brought a lot of different things into my life artistically as well. It's something that's always happened with me, which is when I go through something emotional that's very jarring or very emotional, something happens creatively inside of me. New avenues open up, a new vocabulary is discovered. And one of those vocabularies was color in my work when the first execution happened. When I was here, it was more than a decade ago, but it jarred me completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to explore the way in which you conceive of and are inspired by and what you say through your art. But before we, in our minds, get off of death row here to there, I want to know, do you know Vicente Benavides Figueroa?
He lived very close to me, about 10 cells from me at one point, and then he was moved out of tier several years ago. I didn't know the man very well. I knew who he was, and I'd seen him a number of times walk by my cell on the way to yard.
So for people who don't know, Vicente Figueroa was on death row for almost 25 years after being convicted of raping and murdering a toddler. But he was recently released in late April when it was revealed that medical testimony at his trial was false. So he's now 68 years old and free. You know, how does that come across and ripple through death row?
You know, a lot of guys haven't spoken much about it, but I had the opportunity to watch him leave the gates. And it's hard to explain what I felt, because in one sense, I felt very happy for him that he was going home, that if in fact he was convicted of a crime he never committed, the most horrible thing in the world would be put in prison, especially for the murder of a child, and spent all these years trying to explain to people that, hey, look, I didn't do this. But at the end of the game, he was released. That's one side of the story. Another part of the story was that I looked at him, a 68-year-old man. When he came to prison, he had black hair, a black mustache, and to see him live in the state of mind or the state of being, physical being, that he was in was heart-wrenching. Because I, too, now no longer have black hair and a black mustache. My hair is white. My mustache is white. I came in here as a teenager, a boy, and now I'm an elderly guy. I'm in my 50s. So it jarred me to see that happen. And then a part of me also thought that I wish that someday I can experience walking out of these gates, you know, into the arms of family or friends.
Now, I'd love to talk about your art. I'm wondering if you can describe some of your work. I know you've gone through several different artistic phases and evolutions in different ways. Describe something that you've recently worked on.
Right now I'm working on a series entitled Abstract Scape. And to explain that is I have to go to the beginning, which is my viewpoints on art. You know, art is always and will continue to be a necessity in my life. It's not a luxury. I came to art out of a need, and without that need, you basically create nothing. To me, art has never been about pretty pictures. There had to be something to be said, otherwise it's as relevant as wallpaper. With this particular series, that it is the vocabulary in abstraction, I'm basically showing the viewer the landscape of my confinement. These pieces are thunderous cascades of color that invoke emotion. And you mentioned the first execution here at San Quentin. It jarred me so much that like a tide, an ocean tide of color began to flow into my life. And I accepted that. I began to work with color. I wanted to invoke emotion. I want my paintings to be felt, not really seen. And if they are aesthetically pleasing to the eye, then so be it. But if they're ugly, then that is okay too. As long as the content and the intention that I have is, you know, you can hear it, you can feel it, then I've accomplished my goal.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you had painted for hours today already. What's your process in creating a painting?
Well, yeah, every day I spend 12 to 14 hours painting. The process is one, I don't leave a lot to chance. I control the entire process. I work on a steel bunk. I lay the structure there. And I begin to build from there, from laying gesso to the paint. And I normally don't use traditional tools. I use mirrors for squeegees. The process is one always with a very deliberate intent. And for me, it's all about control. I have to do the entire thing. There has to be a connection with the painting, with the process at all times. If you lose that connection with the painting, how do you expect someone to connect with it? The painting is about everything that's internal inside of me, and I'm making it external so people can see it and look at it for enemies and for friends alike. There has to be a connection there. And that's what I hope to accomplish in my paintings, is to touch an individual. You know, some people have even told me and written that once in front of one of my paintings or artworks, that they have fallen to their knees and began laughing. In other cases, they began to cry. That person was a sensitive viewer. That person connected with that painting, and a dialogue erupted between the two of them. If that happens, I feel like I've accomplished my goal.
It strikes me that, you know, many people probably wonder how you even get paints and materials that you need on death row.
Well, we're allowed to order materials from vendors, and I order all my paint through a vendor. It's delivered to my cell, along with whatever else I need, brushes or all the materials, and from there I work. I just create. I mean, this place kind of allows me to get away from the tyranny of connectiveness. I don't have a lot of distractions, and when my cell door closes, that fear leaves me. I'm able to abandon myself to these powers that I can invoke, but not altogether control. And that's very important to my process.
Now, tell me a little bit more about that theory of the tyranny of connectedness.
Well, today, many of people are on the internet. They're always connected to their phone. You know, I see TV commercials sometimes. People are walking and they fall over because they're so connected to this whole world of connectiveness, which is the internet and all these things. And it just seems to me that you really don't do a lot of thinking. You just an automatic pilot in a way. So I don't have any of those distractions. I have, you know, distraction when I go outside, but I'm dealing with that in a compartment. I compartmentalize it. But when I get back into my cell and they close the door, there's nothing you can interrupt. I mean, even this phone, they had to bring it to me, to my cell. The food port is open. I reach out. I pick up the receiver. I make a phone call. But once that phone, I hang up that phone, I'm disconnected from everything again. So to me, that's what I call the tyranny of connectiveness, which is what everybody's dealing with mostly out there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are really feeling that. And I've found myself, and you know, I go in and I work with inmates at San Quentin on San Quentin Radio, that there really is kind of a freedom of intellect and a depth of thought that people have and feel comfortable talking about, and talking about emotions and philosophy more so often than they do outside of the walls of San Quentin, which is ironic, really, that there's almost an intellectual freedom, maybe an emotional freedom that can come from being incarcerated because you are disconnected from what's going on in the world.
Yeah, what a price to pay, huh?
Yeah.
What a price to pay for a little bit of peace of mind and a little bit of self-awareness. But unfortunately for some of us, that is some of the keys we have looked for through our lives to be able to come to this particular place. But yeah, what a price. You know, you had to go to prison to find a little bit of freedom. And that almost sounds...
You had 60 seconds remaining.
That almost sounds like a cliche, but it really isn't. And I deal with that every single day.